They would show me their vision boards from some seminar, and I would ask, "So what are the top 3 big leaps you're going to make starting on Monday now that you have these new vision boards?" They usually lacked any sort of response or plan, never understanding that one act of courage is better than 100 vision boards. I'm sure you've been frustrated with others or even yourself about the inability to take bolder action. So what was the real problem? And what was the solution? I've learned that the issue is really one of mindset. We are less courageous as a society today because we avoid struggle. And that decision leaves us with underdeveloped character and strength, 2 key ingredients for courage. Here's what I mean. We're at a unique time in history when more countries and communities have greater abundance than ever before. But in such blessings, there can be a curse. People can become resistant to struggle. Today, making any recommendations that would require real effort, trial, difficulty, or patient persistence is out of fashion. Ease and convenience reign. People often quit marriages and school and jobs and friendships at the first sign of difficulty. If you quit at the first sign of difficulty in your everyday life, what are the odds you'll persist in the face of real fear or threat? If we're ever going to develop the strength that courage requires, we'll have to get better at dealing with life's basic challenges. We'll have to stop getting so annoyed and start seeing the struggle as part of growing our character. We must learn to honor the struggle. Unfortunately, struggle is a hard sell. In my industry, for example, I'm constantly told to make my advice and curriculum less complex and rigorous and more appealing. Don't make them work, they say. Don't give them too many steps that are hard, Brendan, because they won't implement them. Dumb it down. Make it easy. Make sure it's digestible for a 6th grader. People don't want to try, so just give them easy things to do. I was told each of these things while writing this book. The presupposition in these statements is that people are lazy, hate challenge, and will trade growth for comfort and certainty. Consider how often we're sold this assumption. In the general media world, especially, every tip and hack is framed so that it's making life super easy, pulling us away from any pain or strain. Focus only on your strengths because you'll feel better and serve better. No need to suffer through facing your shortcomings. That would be uncomfortable and not worth the effort. Outsource everything because there's no value in learning real skills. Hack your diet with a magical pill so you don't have to change your horrible eating patterns. We are surrounded by memes and media and influencers telling us we're not supposed to struggle, that life should be an easy flow, or we're working on the wrong track. Imagine what that's doing to our abilities. Imagine what that is doing to our odds of ever taking courageous action. If we keep telling people to do what's easy, why would they ever think to do what's hard? The good news is, I think people worldwide are discovering that all these quick fixes, hacks, and silver bullets aren't enough. People are beginning to remember something they knew already. To achieve excellence requires hard work, discipline, routines that can become boring, the continual frustrations that accompany learning, adversities that test every measure of our heart and soul, and above all, courage. I hope the research in this book has helped you discover a bigger picture, that high performance requires real intention and the mastering of complex habits. The practices here are doable, but they will still require focus, struggle, and faithful diligence over the long haul. I'm sure older generations could tell us about a time when struggle wasn't something to be avoided. They knew that living a comfortable life, free of all difficulty and all passion, was never the goal. They didn't expect to have a smooth ride. They would tell us that toil and struggle are the fire in which we forge character. They championed the ideals of getting dirt under your fingernails, working harder than anyone else would expect, striving for a dream with a fierce tenacity, even in the face of hardship, because those efforts made you a better, more capable human. Meeting struggle with poise and dignity got you respect. It made you a leader. Forgive me if this sounds nostalgic, but it's nonetheless true. No one who achieved greatness avoided struggle. They met it, engaged with it. They knew that it was necessary because they knew that real challenge and hardship pushed them, extended their capabilities, made them rise. They learned to honor the struggle. They developed a mindset that anticipated the struggle, welcomed the struggle, leveraged the struggle into reasons to give more. By meeting the conflicts and difficulties and outright messes of life straight on, willingly, we dismantle the walls of fear, brick by brick. This mindset, more than any other, is at the heart of my work. Read the Motivation Manifesto, The Charge, or Life's Golden Ticket, and you will see a deep respect, almost reverence, for struggle. When we learn to see struggle as a necessary, important, and positive part of our journey, then we can find true peace and personal power. The alternative, of course, is crippling. Those who hate the struggle or fear it end up complaining, losing motivation, and quitting. Our most recent research also backs up this idea of honoring the struggle. One of the strongest predictors we found is that courageous people agree with the statements, "I love trying to master new challenges," and "I'm confident I can achieve my goals despite challenge or resistance." High performers simply do not dread challenge, failure, or the inevitable difficulties that learning and growing entail. Instead, they love trying to master new things, and they feel confident they can achieve their goals despite potential hardships. Talk to them about difficult times in their past when circumstances forced them out of their comfort zones to perform, grow, or win, and they'll speak of those times with reverence, not dread. Our findings align with decades of psychological research on people with a growth mindset. People with such a mindset believe they can improve, love a challenge, and engage with difficulty rather than run from it. They don't fear failure as much as others do because they know they can learn and, through hard work and training, become better. This makes them more motivated, more dogged in their pursuits, more resilient, and more successful over the long term in practically every area of their lives. Those with fixed mindsets believe and behave the opposite. They believe that their abilities, intelligence, and traits are set, fixed, limited. They don't think they can change and win, and that creates fear anytime they are faced with something that lies beyond their natural strengths and capabilities. They dread failure because failure would be a commentary on them. They feel that a mistake or error makes them look incompetent. If something isn't easy, they give up. To illustrate how destructive this can be, research has shown that those with a fixed mindset are 5 times more likely to avoid challenges than those with the growth mindset. This jibes with what we see in high performers versus low performers. If you are unwilling to anticipate or endure the inevitable struggles, mistakes, messes, and difficulties of life, then it's a rough road. Without courage, you'll feel less confident, happy, and successful. The data confirms it. The two human stories. You should never view your challenges as a disadvantage. Instead, it's important for you to understand that your experience facing and overcoming adversity is actually one of your biggest advantages. Michelle Obama. There are only 2 narratives in the human story: struggle and progress. And you can't have the latter without the former. All those ups and downs are what make us most human. There are supposed to be lows and there are supposed to be highs so that we may experience the full range of what it is to be human, knowing both joy and despair, loss and triumph. We know that, but we often forget it when things get tough. It's easy to hate the struggle, but we mustn't, because over time, hate only magnifies its object into a phantom far greater and more ominous than the actual thing. We must accept that struggle will either destroy us or develop us. And the hardest of human truths is that ultimately, it's our choice. No matter how difficult it gets, the next step is still your choice. For that, let's be thankful. We can go beyond gratitude to true reverence for life's challenges. In talking with high performers, it's clear that to excel, you must teach yourself to view struggle as a stepping stone to strength and higher performance. That's part of the high-performing mindset. Struggle must be seen as part of the process, and a vitally important part of any worthwhile endeavor. And the very decision to accept struggle draws courage from deep within us. The struggle I'm now facing is necessary, and it's summoning me to show up, be strong, and use it to forge a better future for myself and my loved ones. Honoring the journey doesn't mean you just take the adversity and roll with the punches, doing nothing to improve. This isn't about just being zen and accepting life as it comes without trying to exert your will when you're unhappy. It just means that you adopt the mindset that facing hardship and trying to learn can bring the best from you. Accepting that difficult times will come allows you to wake with a sense of realism and readiness to anticipate problems and be prepared for them, to maintain calm when the winds of change might topple lesser leaders. Having that affinity for engagement and action defines part of the high-performance mindset. The difficulties in life that you can't avoid, engage them wholeheartedly. Even when you feel overwhelmed, choose to go for a walk, focus on your breath, and consider the problem rather than avoid it. Look the problem in the eye and ask, what is the next right action for me to take right now? If you aren't yet ready to take that action, plan, study, prepare yourself for when the fog lifts and you are called to lead. I'll end this section with two related sayings that my students find helpful. The first I learned from working with members of the U.S. Army Special Forces. They told me about a common maxim they use to help people realize they must deal with the hardships of service. Embrace the suck. Sometimes doing your duty sucks. Training sucks. Patrol sucks. The weather sucks. Circumstances suck. But you can't just avoid them or be bitter. You have to deal with it. Face it. And will yourself to persevere and rise. You have to embrace the suck. If there's one thing I respect most about the military, it's how little complaining there is. Complaining isn't respected or perpetuated. That inspires me. In any area of your life, if you have the opportunity and blessing to serve, you don't complain about the effort involved. The second saying that might serve you in embracing and honoring the struggle, you will make it through. Just because they can't see your potential or don't share your vision, just because you're uncertain or afraid, that doesn't disqualify you. Just because the sky is cloudy doesn't mean there's no sun. Trust that things turn out. People often say to count your blessings in times of hardship, but I'm reminding you to count on the blessings too. The universe is abundant and giving, so you can trust that good things are coming your way. I suppose that's the ultimate message in times of difficulty, to have faith in yourself and the future. It's something I wrote on an index card and carried in my wallet when I was struggling through my brain injury. Remember, you are stronger than you think, and the future holds good things for you. Practice 1 Performance Prompts is listed on page 274 of High Performance Habits. Performance prompt number 1. A struggle I've been facing in my life is... Number 2. The way I could change my view of this struggle is... Number 3. If something great could come from the struggle, it would be... Number 4. The way I choose to greet life's inevitable hardships from today forward is... Practice 2. Share your truth and ambitions. As far as I can judge, not much good can be done without disturbing something or somebody. Edward Blake. In the Motivation Manifesto, I argued that it is the main motivation of humankind to be free, to express our true selves and pursue our dreams without restriction, to experience what may be called personal freedom. Our spirits soar when we feel unencumbered by fear or the weight of conformity, when we live our truth, expressing who we really are, how we really feel, what we really desire and dream of, then we are authentic. We are free. This requires courage. Surely, no one wants to live a constrained, conforming life, but since Manifesto's release, I've received thousands of letters and comments about just how hard personal freedom is to achieve. Showing the world who you are, authentically and unapologetically, brings a great deal of risk. People often talk about that, how they want to be real, but doing so invites so much judgment or rejection. They're worried that if people could see who they really are, the show would be over. They wouldn't measure up to others' expectations. But I say the only time you should try to measure up to someone else's idea of who you are or what you're capable of is when that person is a role model, cheering you on. If someone believes in you and sees greatness in you, sure, try to live up to that. But for anyone who doubts or diminishes you, forget about it. Don't bother trying to please them. Live a life that is yours. Don't seek the approval of the doubters. You'll find no lasting joy in seeking acknowledgement from others. If it comes, it'll never be enough. So the only path left is to express your own truth and pursue your own dreams. When you do this, you'll meet with inevitable criticism. Anticipate that as just one more part of the struggle. Judgment will always be there, just as there will always be cloudy days. Don't let their criticisms sway you from your convictions. If you believe in your dream, stay on your path. You need no permission beyond that tingling hope in your soul. After talking with so many high performers, I have to confess that I hope you meet with judgment and friction. It's a sign you're on your own path and aiming for great things. Indeed, if no one has looked at you sideways lately, or better yet said, "Who do you think you are? What are you, crazy? Are you sure that's a good idea?" then maybe you're not living boldly enough. I've shared this sort of coaching before. Once I got a message from a fan who countered, "But Brendan, I'm not proud of who I am, and so I don't want to put myself out there. I'm embarrassed at who I am. My truth isn't something I want to share." I could only reply, "My friend, if you're ashamed of the truth, then you've yet to find the truth." Minimizing ourselves. Only those who will risk going too far can possibly find out how far one will go. T.S. Eliot. One thing I didn't expect from readers of The Motivation Manifesto was a different kind of fear in sharing their truth. Many people wrote in and said they weren't worried that others would judge them as insufficient. They were worried that by being their best, they would make others feel insufficient. They were fearful of expressing their true ambitions, joy, and powers because the people around them could feel bad about themselves. They felt they had to minimize their dreams, keep their big ideas bottled up, dumb themselves down, tone it down, look down, all so others could feel good about themselves. When I receive concerns like this, I'll often send my readers a video I shot from my phone where I say, "Do not dare play small, my friend. Do not feel guilt because you have high aims. Those dreams were seated in your soul for a reason, and it is your duty to honor them. Do not hold back in life just to comfort or placate those around you. Holding back is not humility. It's lying. If the people in your life do not know your true thoughts, feelings, needs, and dreams, do not blame them. It is your lack of voice or vulnerability or power, not their lack of understanding or ambition, that is building the barricade to your potential. Share more, and you'll have real relationships that can support you, energize you, lift you. Even if they don't support you or believe in you, at least you lived your life. At least you put it all on the table. At least you honored the hopes of your heart and the calling of your soul. In your full expression lies your freedom. My friend, your next level of performance begins at your next level of truth." I know you're getting a lot of coaching in this chapter, but this is crucial. Readers still write me years later saying my message helped them. I want you to keep this audiobook handy so you can listen to it again the next time concern for someone else's feelings tempts you to hold back your own dreams. So please, stay with me. I have no doubt that accessing the next level of courage in your life requires a new degree of openness and honesty about who you are, what you want, and what you're really capable of and ready to do. all that stands in your way is that fearful part of you that feels like minimizing yourself so that you don't make others feel bad. But don't for one minute think that's humility. That's lying about your real ambitions. That's apologizing for the gifts that God, the universe, fortune, or hard work, take your pick, blessed you with. And it's insidious. Unless you choose to let it go, that fear will forever prevent you from feeling truly authentic and fulfilled and living out your real potential. It will drive you to lower your sights and miss out on excellence. And for what, exactly? You may think, people will be threatened by my drive and desire. They might not like my ambitions. They might make fun of me. So I'd best keep quiet. It's better to downgrade my ambition or work ethic anyway. I've heard every version and permutation of that misbegotten idea. But I want to say it again and etch it on your mind. This kind of thinking is not humility, my friend. It's fear. It's lying. It's suppressing. It's adolescent concern. And it will destroy any real aliveness and authenticity in your relationships. I know it may feel better in the short term to minimize yourself so someone else can feel good about themselves, but consider this. No one wants to be in connection with a fake person. How would you feel if you were in a relationship with someone for 5 years and out of nowhere they said to you, "You don't know the real me. I haven't been honest with you. All this time I've been holding back my real dreams from you because I was scared of you or I thought you were too small-minded to handle it." Would that bring you close to them or would it upset you? How would you respond to that person? You'd probably be astounded and hurt. So why would you do that to someone else by holding back? Look, if you're gulping back your real thoughts and dreams just to fit in or make others feel better, then you can't blame them or anyone else because it's you choking yourself. And while you're at it, you're squeezing the life out of your relationships. I've seen a lot of people from all over the world martyr themselves under the guise of poorly conceived humility. But there's nothing humble in saying, "I'd better not shine because the timid souls around me couldn't handle it." Please. I've worked with enough people to know your likely gut reaction to this. You'll think, "Well, Brendan, you don't understand my husband, my community, my culture, my mom, my coach, my fans, my brand, my insert excuse here." And right now, it's my job to call you out on this. No one can quiet you without your permission. No one can minimize your self-image but you. And no one can open you up and release your full power but you. You can always blame them for your failure to be real and vulnerable. Or you can choose this very day to start speaking up and living in full, even though some may not like it. Will some people make fun of you? Might a person you love doubt you or leave you? Could your teammates call you crazy and marginalize you? Can your neighbors or fans turn on you for wanting more than you deserve? To each of these questions, yes. But which is nobler? Falling dutifully in line with what everyone wants, or speaking up for what's right for you? Ultimately, you must ask which your life is about, fear or freedom. One choice is the cage, the other, that's courage. My passion on this topic is boundless because I've been in the trenches with enough people to know that at some point, someone, I or one of your mentors or a whisper from deep inside you, will get through and get you to share yourself with the world. You don't have to listen to all this from some author you've probably never even met. But if I've somehow held your attention this far, then you may as well bear with me a little longer. You must beware. Holding back will weigh on your mind and your life with stresses you may not see for a long time. It will cheat the people around you from ever discovering your true beauty or abilities. Worse, it will prevent the right people from coming into your life. I see this all the time. A successful person fails to achieve the next level of success because they chose to strive in silence. They don't want to share or speak up. They're trying to be appropriate, realistic, level-headed. They're trying to make others happy or comfortable. And so they have these brilliant ideas, and not only do they not share them, they make the most lethal mistake of all. They don't ask for help. If you don't ask for help, the right people can't come into your life. So if the universe isn't giving you what you want, perhaps it's because amid all your distractions and silence, the universe just doesn't know what you're asking for. Recently, I worked with an Olympic gold medalist. I asked, "When did the biggest gains come in your career?" She said, "When I finally started voicing my dreams to do this. Suddenly, people started pointing me in the right direction. They told me what to do, what skills I would need, who I should talk to, what equipment the pros used, who the best coaches were. I learned that if you open your mouth and shout from the rooftops what you want to do with your life, sure, some village idiots will show up and shout back all the reasons why you can't, but all the village leaders come over and want to help. Life's great that way. The people who are in your life for the right reasons will listen to your truth. They'll applaud your ambition. They'll be happy to meet the person behind the face. They'll thank you for sharing, for being real, for trusting them. Trust others with your truth, and the golden values of real friendship and love reveal themselves like lost treasures. To find even more courage, remind yourself that you owe it to those who have supported you in the past. Stay strong in recognition of the strength they have given you. As a gift to all those who have been good to you, don't complain. Act. Don't criticize. Cheerlead. Don't conform. Live your truth. Don't be selfish. Serve. Don't take the easy path. Strive for growth and an extraordinary life. And when things are falling apart, stay true to the best of who you are, for those are the moments when you're forging who you will become. The simple conversations. The most important thing in connecting authentically with others is to share your true desires with them. They don't have to approve or help or even brainstorm with you. This isn't about them. This is about you having the courage to open to others just as the universe remains open to you. Try it. Each day, reveal to others a little bit more of what you're thinking, feeling, dreaming of. Even if you don't get the immediate support of the humans in front of you, who knows? Perhaps a distant force is unlocked, and the necessary ripples in time and luck and destiny converge and deliver to your door a hint about the next step, a treasure map of sorts, unearthed by your own courage. This habit doesn't take shape by a single momentous conversation with everyone you know. You don't have to sit everyone you love down and tell them all the reasons you've been holding back from them and from life. You don't have to shoot a video explaining your entire life and philosophy. Instead, just make it a daily practice to be sharing your thoughts and goals and feelings with others. Every day, share something with someone about what you really think and want in life. You could say, "You know, honey, today I was thinking about starting X because I'd love to Y. For example, I was thinking about researching how to write a book because I think I have a story worth telling. I was thinking about starting to hit the gym every morning because I love to feel more vital and alive. I was thinking about starting to look for another job because I'd love to feel more passionate and appreciated. I was thinking about starting to cold call some new coaches because I'm ready to compete at a higher level." These are simple statements. It's a simple formula. What do you want to share? Whatever it is, share it. Then take bold action each day to bring it to reality. Performance prompts for practice number 2 of The Habit of Courage is on page 281 of High Performance Habits, the book, or you can download it at highperformancehabits.com/tools. Performance prompts. Number 1, something I really want to do that I haven't shared with enough people is. Number 2, if I were going to be more me in my everyday life, I would start to. Number 3, when I put myself out there and someone makes fun of me, I'm just going to. Number 4, a major dream I'm going to start telling people about and asking for some help with is. Practice 3, find someone to fight for. I don't know what your destiny will be, but one thing I know, the only ones among you who will be really happy are those who will have sought and found how to serve. Albert Schweitzer. In 2006, I was broke. I had done what I have been trying to inspire you to do. I took action. I had quit my job to be a writer and trainer. I told everyone about my dream. Plenty of people thought I was crazy, including, at times, me. I didn't know how to write or publish a book. No one knew me, and I had no supportive connections. Facebook, YouTube, and iTunes were still in their infancy. Getting your voice out there was hard. I just wanted to share with people what I had learned from my car accident, that at the end of our lives, we will ask ourselves questions to evaluate whether we were happy with our lives. If you can figure out the questions you'll ask, then you can wake up each day and live intentionally so you'll be happy with the answers at the end. I learned that those questions for me were, did I live? Did I love? Did I matter? I stayed up late each night teaching myself to build websites and do online marketing because I wanted to reach a lot of people with that simple message. I was living in my girlfriend's apartment because I was so broke. I wrote on a fold-out desk borrowed from my mother's old sewing room. The apartment was so small that I used the bed as a credenza where I stacked all my bills and notes and fears. It was a tough time for me personally. The guy who would become the guy on motivation and high-performance habits had very little of either. I knew what I wanted, to write, to train. I had that quote from Horace on my fridge, "In times of stress, be bold and valiant." And yet, many days passed while I did nothing to move forward on either desire. I remember days sitting in a cafe, watching other people type on computers and thinking, what a phony I am. Look at them work. I'm barely doing anything. I would get up and walk around the park, telling myself I needed to get in more inspired settings, telling myself that a walk would clear my head and make me write better. I circled that park for weeks and months, and my head was as muddled as ever. My motivation hadn't risen to the level of my dreams, nor had my habits. I was going to set all these alarms and mental triggers to wake up at precise hours each day and begin writing, after, of course, boiling the perfect cup of green tea, cooking the best omelet, activating the perfect state to write in. I followed the habits sometimes, and they led to more dirty plates than written pages. Not all good habits lead to impressive results, especially when a key ingredient is missing. And then, a very simple moment changed everything. One night, I watched my girlfriend walk into the bedroom, and trying not to disturb me or the bills or notes I had strewn all over the bed, slip quietly beneath the covers. I saw the love of my life sleeping under the weight of my bills. It broke my heart. I gazed around the tiny apartment that I was contributing no money for because I had none, a space that had nothing but the love between us, an apartment where I sat useless, sad, unable to finish pages and chapters, and the mission I dreamt of. And I thought, this is not the life I want for us. She deserves better. At that moment, something inside me snapped or opened up or fell into place. Maybe my level of performance up to that point was okay for my preferences or needs in life, but I wasn't going to let my weak motivation or bad habits diminish the life of this woman who believed in me when everyone else thought I was crazy, the woman who bought me groceries, the woman who, too early in our relationship, admitted shyly, I love you. You know when it's courage because somehow there is an all-in decision. Often, it doesn't come from you. It comes from wanting to serve another, to love another, to fight for another. Either I was going to become a successful writer and trainer, staying focused on helping people, whatever the obstacles, fighting for this woman until I ended up successful or what? There was no other choice. From that moment, I decided to follow my dreams with more focus and intensity. I was not going to waste my days meandering about, lost in distractions. I decided to think bigger, to stop letting my small business make me small-minded. I decided to fight for my art and amplify my voice so that I might make a greater difference. I decided not to worry about the critics and instead give my whole heart and effort to those who wanted positivity and progress in life. And I decided to marry that girl. Fighting for the life I wanted for us has kept me driven and contributing at the highest levels ever since. My story isn't all that unusual. While writing this chapter, I went back through my interviews with the highest level of high performers, those with the highest average scores across the HP6. I found that a common theme was similar to the story I just shared. We will do more for others than for ourselves. And in doing something for others, we find our reason for courage and our cause for focus and excellence. Each of the highest performing people I interviewed told me about someone who inspired them to excel. They all had a reason, and that reason was often a person, not always a purpose or a group of people, most often just one person. Sometimes it was more than one, their kids, their employees, their extended family, their community's need. But more often than not, it was just one. I share this because our culture today often emphasizes finding your life's purpose. And it's always this great, monumental cause that is destined to change the world and benefit millions. A lot of people search, and some find that high purpose in life. And surely, that's a wonderful thing to have. The historical research on courage in general suggests that people do things for noble causes beyond themselves. For high performers, that noble cause usually happens to be just one person or a few people. And so, if you are a young person being told to find your purpose right now, don't feel that you have to look too far. Perhaps someone around you needs you to show up for them. And in doing that, you'll bring to light some of your own powers. And if you are an older adult, remember those around you, even as you seek that next mountain to climb. What I found in my research was something so obvious that it's beautiful. No matter what pulled courage from these high performers, it was something noble. You would admire their reason for doing it. There was human goodness there. Some answers from their interviews make this clear. She needed me. There was no other choice I could live with than to help her. I didn't want them to suffer. No one seemed to care, and there I was. I wanted to do it for him. He would have wanted that. Everyone else seemed to look the other way, so I stepped up. I wanted to leave a legacy, so I decided to get out of my own way and go for it. This action was a way to leave things better than I found them. Love had to win, so I went back in. Sometimes courage appears to be a spontaneous act, but what I have found is that it's usually an expression or action built up from years of caring deeply about something or someone. So begin seeking things and people you care about. Give. Care deeply about something now. Stand up for something now. And then you'll be more likely to find courage when it matters. Performance prompts. Number one, a courageous action I will take this week because someone I love needs me to take it is. Number two, another courageous action I will take this week because a cause I believe in needs me to take it is. Number three, another courageous action I will take this week because my dream requires it of me is. These performance prompts are found on page 286 of High Performance Habits. Courage through complexity. Courage and perseverance have a magical talisman before which difficulties disappear and obstacles vanish into air. John Quincy Adams. Just as the universe doesn't become less complex, life doesn't tend to get easier, but you get stronger. You learn how to show up more, cope better, and be truer and more conscious amid the judgment and hardship. Soon, the obstacles do begin to seem smaller, and the path seems more your own. So no matter what happens, trust in yourself and lean forward. The next level opens after your next courageous step. After more and more of those steps, you will look back with self-respect. Allow me to return to something I shared in the opening story of this chapter. The kinds of courageous acts that you are proud of at the end of your life are those in which you faced uncertainty and real risk with real stakes when doing something for a cause or person beyond yourself without any assurance of safety, reward, or success. I know this to be true because I've faced the end of my life before, twice. I know this because I've sat with people dying in hospice, and I know what they talk about, how they reminisce, what they wish they had done, what mattered to them, where their self-respect and pride and legacy came from. And here's what I've learned. For most people, courageous acts are indeed rare events. But we remember those acts, and they shape our sense of ourselves and our lives as much as the small stuff. And so I ask you to consider these questions I'm about to ask you often, to ready your mind for even more courage. Only by conditioning ourselves now will we truly serve with grace and courage when called. What in my personal life have I avoided doing, which might involve hardship, but just might improve my family's lives forever? What could I do at work that would require stepping out on a limb, but would also truly change things for the better and help people? What decision could I make that would demonstrate a moral commitment to something higher than myself? How could I bring myself to face a situation that usually makes me nervous or anxious? What change could I make that scares me but will help someone I love? What good thing could I walk away from to advance my life? What have I wanted to say to those close to me? And when and how will I courageously declare that truth? Who needs me? And who will I fight for the rest of this year? These questions might spur some brave thinking and action today. Ask them enough and practice the habits in this chapter, and you'll come to this truth. Deep down, away from all the noise, where love blankets your heart and your dreams lie in wait, you are not afraid. Section 3, Sustaining Success. High performance killers, beware three traps. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. William Shakespeare, Julius Caesar. This chapter has three practices. Beware superiority, beware dissatisfaction, beware neglect. That's him over there, Andre tells me. Dreadful Don. I look across the bar to the well-dressed executive Andre is pointing to. Why do you call him that? Andre furrows his brow. We all call him that. They called him that long before I got here. He's the VP of sales. Miserable to work with. Everyone hates him. But I thought you said he's the star performer in your company. For the moment, yes. He's successful, but a total jerk. This party tonight is happening only because he crushed it so hard the whole sales team made its numbers 2 months early. When you talk to him tomorrow, I'm sure he'll be delighted to tell you how awesome he is. I'm surprised to hear Andre talk like this. He's a very centered, solid, likable CFO of a major manufacturing company. I coached him at another company for years and never heard him speak ill of anyone. He's been at this job for just 6 months, and it's hard to imagine that someone has gotten under his skin so quickly. Something isn't computing. I see Don surrounded by his coworkers, and they all seem to be having a good time. I don't get it, I say to Andre. If he's a total jerk, as you say, then how does he keep getting ahead? Won't people stop supporting him at some point, and then he'll crash and burn? Andre takes a sip of his single malt and laughs. Oh, they already have. He just doesn't know it yet. The next morning, Andre brings me into the company headquarters. He's getting paid twice what he did at his old job, but as we enter the building, I can sense he isn't happy to be here. You'll see why, he tells me. We walk into the conference room, where Don is checking his PowerPoint. Today, he's leading the quarterly sales meeting, where he sets the tone and path to make the company's goals. His entire sales team of 144 people is here. The C-suite, who Andre has brought me in to coach, is also here. CEO, CTO, CMO. I've worked with them all for just a few weeks, and all of them asked me to work with Don. They've arranged for me to meet with him after his presentation and assess whether I can help. I watched Don give what many would consider a stellar 90-minute presentation. He's strategic, organized, and articulate. He has that sort of forward lean and swagger that makes you want to go charge onto the battlefield with him. After the presentation, I meet with Don privately. I ask, how do you think your talk went? It was good enough. You're never really satisfied with a speech, you know. You always think of something else you could tell him. Yeah, I know the feeling. How do you think the audience received it? Most of it probably went over their heads, but it's just a meeting. It's my job to stay on top of them and really push them to execute from here. It takes a lot of follow-up. You know how it is. It seemed pretty straightforward to me, I say. You think it went over their heads? Hey man, you know, it's lonely at the top. So you just hope you can explain your point of view well. Lonely at the top? You know what I mean. Not everyone gets us, you know? The best? I'm sure you've learned that working with so many winners. Maybe you can help me turn these guys into champions. They just don't get it, you know? I say nothing and just wait for him to share more. He looks at me quizzically. You do know what I mean, right? You know? I debate whether we have enough of a relationship that I can tell him the truth. He doesn't know that his attitude and the phrase, lonely at the top, are reliable omens for every great downfall I've ever seen. Hey man, you can tell me what you're thinking. Say it straight. I don't have a lot of time today. I can handle you. I promise. He says, laughing. Nothing you'll say will hurt my feelings. Promise. Okay, good. I think you have 6 months tops before you destroy your career. This is a chapter about failure. But not just any kind of failure. It's about the calamitous fall from grace that high performers can experience when they get so good that they forget what made them successful. This chapter is, in effect, the anti-practices of high performance. It's about how people like Don start thinking they are separate from others, better than others, more capable than others, and more important than others, and how those attitudes destroy performance and careers. It's also about the problems that come from the never be satisfied, hustle and grind approach that sucks passion and leads to overcommitment. This is a chapter about the warning signs, the thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that knock high performers out of the sky. Long before I met Don, I had surveyed high performers about what brought an end to previous winning streaks. I surveyed 500 people who had scored in the top 15%, looking for clues. I wanted to know how long they felt they had sustained their success, whether they had ever fallen hard, and whether they ever felt they had risen to such heights again. I asked them open-ended questions such as, when was a time you had an initial period of success, say 3 to 5 years, then suddenly failed? I asked more questions to find out what caused them to fail, how long they were down, how fast they achieved success again, and what factors led to the bounce back. The stories were astoundingly similar to those I had heard working with high performers from all walks of life. I collected the 500 surveys and stories, then did another 20 interviews to learn more. Then I compared all those findings to my own experience coaching high performers over the past 10 years. Obvious patterns emerged. Number one, when high performers fell from grace, the most frequent culprits, aside from failing to practice the habits you've learned in this book, came down to three things. Number two, when high performers rose back up, the habits in this book were the vehicle for that ascension. Number three, when high performers describe such an up and down journey, they clearly never want to make the same mistakes again. The fall was that painful. When you fail at the beginning of a journey, it's frustrating. When you fail hard after making it for so many years, it feels immeasurably worse. So, what were the three things that caused high performers to fall out of prolonged success? Let's start with what didn't cause them to fail. Fear was not the issue. To become high performers, people have learned to get comfortable with the uncomfortable. The people I surveyed didn't report failing because of fear, worry, or holding back. Competence was not an issue. To succeed in the first place, you have to be good at your craft. No one said, gosh, Brennan, I just wasn't skilled enough to stay on top. Other people were not the issue. Of 500 people who responded to my survey, only 7 blamed other people for their stumbles. But even in those cases, the respondents ultimately reasoned that it was their own fault. High performers, especially those who have fallen down and got back up, take personal responsibility for their journey. Creativity was not the issue. I had expected some high performers to say they were passed up because they ran out of good ideas. That didn't happen. Motivation was not the issue. If anything, these high performers were deeply, if not desperately, motivated to climb back up. You could say they had extreme performance necessity. Resources were not the issue. Only 38 of 500 people blamed money or insufficient support as the reason they failed. I spoke with 14 of those 38, and certainly lack of money or support was a ready excuse, but behind that excuse, they accepted a colder, harder truth. They messed up. These issues could certainly be fair and understandable reasons for people to fail. But what I've learned from high performers is that these just aren't the real failure points of sustained performance. The real traps are internal, negative patterns of thinking, feeling, and behaving that slowly kill our humanity, zest, and well-being. The traps are superiority, dissatisfaction, and neglect. If you're going to maintain high performance, you need to maintain your high performance habits and avoid these three traps. Trap number one, superiority. There are two kinds of pride, both good and bad. Good pride represents our dignity and self-respect. Bad pride is the deadly sin of superiority that reeks of conceit and arrogance. John Maxwell. High performers face a unique set of character traps because they are, by definition, outperforming so many around them. When you are succeeding beyond others, it's easy to get a big head. You can begin to think you're special, separate from, better than, or more important than other people. That was obvious in my conversations with Don, and it's what others were sharing about him. This is a way of thinking that you must avoid at all costs. Of course, you probably would never say to yourself, one day, I want to start feeling that I'm better than other people. No one wants to join the ranks of the egomaniacs, narcissists, braggarts, or elitists. You sense that this is true because you've likely met someone who truly believed they were superior to you or others. You can probably think of five people like that right now. And I bet you don't have a positive association with any of them. Superiority has no positive connotation in a healthy mind. But I'm not here to talk about those people. I'm here to caution you that as you get more successful, you can quickly fall prey to the same fatal error. In fact, I'm here to suggest that you, like all humans, are already guilty of subtle thoughts and actions that point to feelings of superiority. You might not be demonstrating a bombastic ego, but there are 100 shades and degrees of superiority. Have you recently thought that some of the people you work with are idiots and that your ideas are always better? Yes, that qualifies. Not asking your team to review your big presentation and find its errors or omissions because you got this? Uh-oh. Getting cut off in traffic, then racing ahead to cut that guy off just to show him who's boss. Yep. Arguing your point over and over to your spouse, even though they have been clear about their position and are not budging. Check. Failing to review your work because it's always good enough? Dang. Minimizing someone else so you can look better? Oops. Discounting another person's ideas because they haven't put in the time you have? Anything here seem familiar? See, superiority draws us off track a quarter inch at a time. When it has a firm hold on us, we begin acting out like jerks. We stop asking people for their input or help because we think we're always right. We lose awareness of others' contributions and powers. We end up soloing, and we destroy the sense of connection and camaraderie that makes high achievement fun and worthwhile. We dismiss people, and we speak in tones of condescension. We start falling prey more often to confirmation bias, interpreting what we see as confirmation of our own beliefs while neglecting or discounting the evidence against it. We lose ourselves to thoughts of superiority that ultimately destroy our relationships and our performance. The good news is, you can learn to spot exactly when and how these thoughts arise in your mind. And with that knowledge, you can avoid buying into them. When is the easy part. The roots of superiority always begin to grow in the soil of separateness and certainty. It's that moment when you begin to think you are separate from others or certain about anything, that you are in greatest danger. Here's how to know when superiority has infiltrated your mind. Number one, you think you are better than another person or group. Number two, you're so amazingly good at what you do that you don't feel you need feedback, guidance, diverse viewpoints, or support. Number three, you feel that you automatically deserve people's admiration or compliance because of who you are, what position you hold, or what you've accomplished. Number four, you feel that people don't understand you. So all those fights and failures are surely not your fault. It's that they just can't appreciate your situation or the demands, obligations, or opportunities you have to sort through daily. When any of these realities is a constant in your life, you've begun the decline, even if you don't know it yet. What these thoughts have in common is a sense of separateness. You just feel so much more capable or accomplished than others that in your mind, there is you at the top and then everyone else. It's this separateness that fueled Don's belief that it's, quote-unquote, lonely at the top. Yet Don isn't alone. A lot of people believe this bizarre idea. People say it because they think others can't possibly comprehend their lives. The problem is, this thought is inaccurate and obscenely destructive. If you've ever felt as if the world can't understand you, then, and I won't bother looking for a gentler way to say this, it's time to pop the bubble you've been hanging out in. We have thousands of years of recorded human history, and over 7 billion people walk this earth today. The odds are pretty good that someone, somewhere, has gone through what you're going through and can easily understand your situation and advise you through it. All isolation is ultimately self-imposed. This is a difficult truth to relay to people who feel that no one can understand them or their situation. I can't tell you how many times I've had to kindly tell someone to abandon their sense of separateness in truly difficult situations. You are not the first entrepreneur to face financial ruin. You are not the first parent to lose a child. You are not the first manager to be cheated by an employee. You are not the first lover to be cheated on. You are not the first striver to lose your dream. You are not the first CEO to run a large global company. You are not the first healthy person to find yourself suddenly battling cancer. You are not the first person to deal with depression or addiction in yourself or a loved one. When we're facing any of these difficulties, it's easy to feel that we're the only one going through the struggle. But that feeling is pure illusion. There is no human emotion or situation you are contending with that someone, somewhere, cannot understand if you are vulnerable and real and open enough to share your thoughts, feelings, and challenges. Yes, you can keep telling yourself that your spouse can't possibly understand, and if you never try, that will be a self-fulfilling prophecy. Their lack of understanding only grows in your silence. Yes, you can tell yourself that no one on your team gets it, but that's just your ego blinding you to the value that others can ultimately add. Discounting others doesn't make you a greater person. You're just choosing to be more separate, ultimately making yourself more vulnerable to failure. I know that when you're trapped in hardship, these statements can feel judgmental or oblivious of your reality. But I respectfully share these ideas with you because I've seen so many good people lose it all. Not through ill intent, but through a sense of separateness that soon makes them dismiss others or fail to ask for help. It never hurts to remind strivers that we all are one human family and that there are really only two stories in the human narrative, both of which all can know and connect to. You might recall these two stories are struggle and progress. People can understand your struggle. They can understand your wins, and they can understand tough choices, even if they themselves have never had to make them. If you don't believe it, then you are telling yourself a story that is not natural, that is disconnected from the reality of 7 billion people who all have hearts and hurts and dreams. Often, when I meet high performers who are so good that they are indeed at the top of their particular food chain, the CEO, the world champion athlete, the most popular person in school, the smartest woman in the room, all have to go further than this oneness argument. I'll have to remind them that someone somewhere is smarter, earns more, serves better, trains harder, and positively affects more people than they do. I don't say that to diminish these paragons, but to connect them to another reality, that whoever you are, what seems a big issue to you, what might be separating you from others in your circle of influence, might be child's play to a bigger fish in another pond. That perspective can prove hopeful. Someone out there has already solved the dilemma, mastered the thing that you believe makes you so different from others. If you can find them, you can find a mentor, a solution, and a path back to reality and humility. A few more points about the lonely at the top syndrome, just because it's just so corrosive. First, I've rarely met a high performer who thinks they're, quote-unquote, at the top. Most feel like they're just getting started. They understand they're still students of life. And no matter how stellar their success, they feel that they're just a few steps in on the path of mastery. This is a widely held attitude with the top scorers of our assessments who I interviewed. Second, here's a special reminder if you have begun dismissing other people's capabilities. You can't maximize your potential while minimizing others. What you have attained in life isn't because